This is your guy?
Yeah.
And that's for the podcast?
Yeah.
So this is the Pulse podcast, yeah.
What's that?
The Pulse podcast. It's under the...
Yeah, the, well, Pulse asked us to do it.
Don't
yeah,
I see?
It's from the part of Pulse, but we usually do podcasts early on.
Good morning, everyone.
Okay. Yeah,
okay. My name is Dee Dee Poches. I'm with the Financial Times, and I wanted to welcome you to this first of a four-day breakfast series brought to you by the Financial Times, Pulse Miami, and the Four Club, and sponsored by the Laurel Condominium in New York City. Welcome to our breakfast with contemporary artists, and let me introduce to you our wonderful moderator this morning, Peter Aston, is the arts writer with the Financial Times based in London, and I will let him take over from here.
Thank you. Thank you, Dee Dee. Is that okay? Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, by way of introduction, I just wanted to tell you all about a remarkable evening I had a few weeks ago. I've been covering the arts for, yeah. I've been covering the arts for about 15 years from London at the Financial Times. And a few weeks ago, I went to an auction in Sotheby's to cover it, a very big auction. And as I was getting ready for it, news began to seep through to the office that Lehman Brothers, I don't need to tell you who Lehman Brothers were, had collapsed, which was, as you can imagine, a fairly big story for the Financial Times. So I went to this very big auction wondering what on earth was going to happen. And some of you may have guessed the auction in question was the sale of 223 new works by Damien Hirst at Sotheby's. And we all were there, and all the talk was about Lehman Brothers, and the whole banking system of the Western world was beginning to collapse. How was this going to affect the auction? Well, as some of you probably know, that auction of 223 brand new works by Damien Hirst made £111 million on the day that Lehman Brothers collapsed. And it was, I guess, what you might call a defining moment. We have very few of those in journalism, but I was very aware that the those of us in the crowd had witnessed a very remarkable evening, and we were trying to make sense of it. And it's all very well to call it a defining moment, but it begs the question, what does it exactly define? So I think it's a really good time, actually, now to discuss the relationship between art and money, or art and mammon, as it used to be known. I like this graphic here, which I just saw for the first time today, which has these coins from all around the world deeply embedded into the palette. It seems to strike the right image, really, of two worlds that are deeply enmeshed with each other, in some ways interdependent, but in some ways hostile to each other too. They kind of find themselves wrestling as well. There's a view that money is corrupting in the art world, but of course the art world's not possible without money too. So it's a very subtle and strange relationship, and I'm really looking forward to being able to talk about it with our two guests, two very fine artists. I'm very pleased that we're starting this series with artists, because it makes a kind of organic sense. Artists are where it all starts. These people are the people who create things that we all desire and pay for and study and reflect on. And I think we're going to be talking about some of the commercial pressures on the art world over the next hour or so. But it's important to remember, I think, that in some ways the most considerable pressure of all is the pressure to create, the pressure to come up with something original and new and distinguished and distinctive and inspiring. That's a really big pressure, I think. So if I may very briefly introduce Leo Villarreal on my left, who is a light artist. I'm not going to attempt to sum up what your work is like in one pithy phrase, because one can get one's fingers burned like that. But his work is behind me. It's next door as well. And he has a very major installation called Multiverse at the Washington National Gallery of Art. And to my right, Alexander Ross, who is a painter who's also has some work at Miami Basel at the David Nolan booth. I said, I'm not going to try and imagine, I'm not going to try and describe their work, but I will steal a phrase that I looked up last night. His work is described in a review as if the hush of Dutch still life were reimagined by HAL. HAL, of course, being the computer that loses its marbles in 2001, A Space Odyssey. But anyway, two very fine artists, and I'm very grateful to you both for joining me here. I'd like to start maybe by asking each of you to talk a little bit about how you started as an artist, how that decision came about in your lives, and also the way, the how and why and when you began to realize that the commercial world existed too, and there was a relationship between art and money, and how you saw that at the beginning of your careers and how that developed. So, Leo, can I ask you to start? Thanks.
Sure. So I wasn't exactly, came to art through complicated means of being interested in theater and set design, and eventually took a installation sculpture class and realized that I wanted to be an artist. I studied sculpture as an undergraduate, and I finished in about 1990. And at that time, computers got very interesting again. I'd been involved with computers early on, like an Apple II Plus computer when I was 13 years old, but kind of left that behind. But in 1990, things like Photoshop started to come out. There was this whole buzz about virtual reality, and there was all these kinds of new tools. And I ended up going to a program at NYU to study new technology, and started doing programming, video editing, a lot of work with virtual reality and interactive television. And from there, I ended up at a research lab in Palo Alto. And all this time, I was interested in these tools, not exactly sure what I was going to do with them. And at a certain point, I didn't realize that I had skills that were valuable. The whole internet started to kind of take off at that time. And so it suddenly, these things I was interested in had some, yeah, it's an ability to actually make money doing that. So that was interesting to me. These things were always a way of, you know, it was always, the purpose was to make art with them, even though I was using these new technologies. So I established my studio in New York about 10 years ago, and that's when I really figured out which tools I was going to use and how I was going to use them. But it was a very long process of discovery and learning, because there's a lot of complication and a lot of things to digest. So I guess gradually, you know, I built it up from there, you know, one piece at a time, and it's really been very incremental for me. You know, one piece has led to the other, led to the other, and doors kind of keep opening. So it's really this evolution.
Yeah, good. Okay, Alexander, can I ask?
Yeah, when I was a child, actually, I right away started exhibiting a natural gift for drawing and art making, so my identity as an artist formed immediately. This is my earliest memories. And from there, it was a short time later when I was handed fine art books, and when I saw the picture of, the black and white picture in the front of the book of the artist in his studio, this fantasy took hold. You know, I could just make art and do whatever I want, and possibly, if I'm lucky, get paid for it and make a living that way, because if Max Ernst can do it and Pablo Picasso. So this fantasy took hold, and I decided against commercial art and other forms, and just kept at this idea of being a painter, because it afforded maximum freedom. And graduated art school in 1983, and had a very long period of gestation, experimentation, trying things, looking for my style and my way of working, and my first solo show was 1998, so at that time I was finally really ready, and I had a body of work, and all of a sudden, after many years of living on rice and beans and really like keeping my overhead low, keeping my life simple, things took off drastically. 1998 is when, maybe you could say, the very beginning of serious economic expansion. So I have to say, for me, the experience was totally exhilarating. My paintings started to sell, I started getting grants, I quit my day job, I suddenly had much more money than I ever had working at any job, and I was able to move out of the city for a while, and
then it just kept growing and growing and growing. So it was sort of incredibly fortunate sequence for me. I feel like I've just had this incredibly good luck my whole life, and it dovetailed perfectly with this expanding economy. So initially it was totally exhilarating and a wonderful shift. But along with that comes, like you said, pressure, and the pressure to make things a particular case, or it's subtle at first, but you start realizing I got to balance this. Like, so it takes a lot of discipline actually to keep your head on straight. Like, I can't let this distort my perception of what I'm doing. The art comes first. Just make it. Don't think about how much it's selling for. Try not to think about what people like more than other pieces. And just do your thing. So there, it's become harder and more precarious and nervous-making. Everything keeps growing, and the size of the studio and the size of the work, and the exhilaration is accompanied by, you know, realistic concerns.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. I mean, I think what both of you have in common, you're both mid-career artists with considerable reputations, and what's striking about the way you both described that was that it was this sense of, as you say, it was an incremental progress, and a sense of one door opening after another, and not being quite sure where you're going. And that seems to me that almost defines what an artist does at the beginning of his or her career. But I just wonder, we've had this amazing boom in contemporary art, and it's not just an art market boom, we can talk about that later, but it's just a very, very broadening and deepening of interest in contemporary art over the last 10 years. What must it be like, do you think, for a young artist, for a 21-year-old now, suddenly entering this world? How do you think he or she is able to find their feet and produce distinctive and original art and find their own voice? Do you think it's possible? How would you go about it?
I think it must be really, really difficult. I feel very fortunate to have had years to develop, and I think Alex had the same experience. Like I went to school, I was at this research lab, and really had time to figure it out. And I think now there's so many galleries prowling around, graduate shows, certainly in New York and all the art schools, and trying to scoop up the new, and I think that must be really tough to suddenly go from zero to 100 and have to produce. And I think it's probably pretty easy to get burned out. I find just being in New York to be very challenging. If I was 21, like I said earlier, I would move to Berlin or someplace where there's space and where you can play with things and not feel so much economic pressure to have to deal with in New York.
But you presumably you'd have to have a very strong sense of yourself to be able to turn down those. I mean, we can call them commercial pressures, but they also must be incredible sense of opportunity. I mean, what you're saying is that finding a space, a physical space and a mental space where you can develop becomes more important.
Yeah. I think it's more important than ever that a young artist really have their head on their shoulders and keep a balanced perspective. Because any young artist, they have to consider all of our history that's come before, and how they could add to that, and what they could possibly say. But now with this flowering of art interest and art making all over the world, a global attention on it, and more interest than ever before, and more avenues for production of art and kinds of art, it's like the confusion at the grocery store where there's just too many choices. I think it would be extremely overwhelming for a young artist to find a path to get on and to tunnel in and to shut the rest out and have the discipline to edit, so information editing.
Yeah, sure. We're in, let's talk about this art boom then, the last 10 years. I mean, when I was growing up, when I was a student, contemporary art was not something you heard very much about. It was quite an esoteric subject and quite strange and enclosed and almost introspective, and didn't, apart from the very top end of the market, didn't command these kinds of prices that we've seen in the last 10 years. What do you think happened? I mean, how do you how do you analyze what's been happening in the last 10 years, the fact that it's suddenly become very hot? I mean, I have my own theories of this. In particular, with as regards the London art scene, I think contemporary art has kind of replaced rock and roll, which is one of the great things that Britain has always been very good at, and it's sort of sadly fizzled out, and it's almost like we needed something new and vital to replace that, and along with its personalities, for example, the young British artists who have become more famous than pop stars, really, in London. But that's just one string to it. I wondered what your thoughts were.
My explanation would be the idea of punctuated equilibrium. For a very long time, interest in art has been sort of a steady state, building. But the more people interact and talk about what they like and how they like art, and the more they learn, the more information is spreading and crisscrossing in social circles. It reaches a maximum point where suddenly it cascades into a new level, and that's it becomes punctuated. And I think that's simply what happened, where on a global level, like, interest in art just suddenly flourished, and we all started thinking about it more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think artists certainly like Murakami and really embracing the market and multiple levels.
Speak into the microphones more. They can't hear you in the back with the trucks out here. So
okay.
If you want to hold it by hand, it might be easier to do it by hand. I want to make sure everyone hears all of your thoughts.
So I think art is becoming more and more part of pop culture, and certainly like. There's a thirst for new and different, and a rejection of kind of corporate top-down structures. So you have artists doing all kinds of new things and productions, and towels and t-shirts and buttons and all these things that you wouldn't like. That are different from the fine art that you see.
Yeah.
And access to the public and kind of embracing all these other levels of the market.
Now, some people, if I may play devil's advocate for a minute, but some people think that that's a sellout. Some people think there's something a little bit impure about art appearing on towels and t-shirts, and it somehow cheapens it. What do you think about it?
I don't think so at all. I think that there's a huge role for art to play on a lot of different levels, and artists are realizing that there are these opportunities and new ways of making things and accessing fabrication, and I think it all has to do with certainly the network and the internet, and finding a fabricator in China or whoever to make all kinds of things. And I think it's just up to artists to decide what it is that we want to make, and figuring out what that idea is. And I don't think it's ever been easier to make things, and I think we need that. It's this kind of individual voice and things that are unique, and I think there's a real thirst and desire for people to have art everywhere in their lives, and not just like in a gallery. It doesn't have to just be there, or it can be there's an explosion in public art and ways of accessing these ideas, and that's really exciting.
Yeah,
it sort of begs the question, why should some fine art be rarefied? Speaks to like a privileged way of thinking about it, and certainly that was the case years ago. But I think that I look at it as sort of an expanding bush of branches, and there's room for all of it, and all the different approaches and ways that art finds its way into the popular culture or doesn't. So there's room for it all. It can coexist simultaneously.
Yeah. I mean, it ought to be emphasized, I think, that the so-called art market boom or bubble or whatever you want to call it, bubble is always a horrible word because it implies that someone's going to pop it with a pin and it'll all come crashing down, which has not, well, it's still a bit early to say. Certainly the last few auctions at New York have been very disappointing, but and maybe that Damien Hirst evening I described at the beginning was some kind of watershed, but on the other hand, you only have to walk around the streets here to see that it's still incredible interest, and I think it's important to emphasize that the interest in contemporary art is much deeper and broader than just a few super rich people playing I can buy a bigger one than you can. Let's talk about public art for a bit, because that's a very interesting part in it. in London, certainly, there seems a limitless thirst. Well, other capitals as well, a thirst to have important, imposing pieces of art again, and perhaps more so than any time since the 19th century and all its great statues and glorifications. What's that all about? What's that telling us about the world?
I've been working a lot with doing large-scale commissions and with museums and commercial buildings, and there is a huge thirst. People working on projects in Dubai and in Istanbul and all over the world, really, which is really exciting. But it's also it's spread out, and this is another thing that is good. Maybe something isn't happening here, it's happening there, and I think the market is, the spread is good. Mm-hmm. And if you have multiple countries and different people involved in different scales of production, I think that all, that all keeps it going. And I think it makes it more resilient, certainly.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess I don't have a thought on that.
No, okay, yeah. Well, I think I was mentioning earlier, I have an eight-year-old daughter in London, and the last three shows, and this is a question about the nature of contemporary art and what role it can play in the education of children and ultimately citizens. I have an eight-year-old daughter, and the last three shows she went to see in London, one was an installation by Martin Creed at Tate Britain of a man sprinting down the gallery every 10 seconds. The other was a recreation of a Fluxus project, this time at Tate Modern, of a giant salad being made. I can't remember the artist, somebody might be able to help me on that. And the one before that was was going down a tubular slide by Carsten Höller, again at Tate Modern, which she found a lot of fun. She had a great time at all three of those, but I found myself thinking, what kind of view is she going to form of what museums are for? Because in my day, well, number one, I wasn't taken to museums when I was eight, but when I was a bit older, I went to museums. I went to the British Museum to look at Assyrian art and Greek art, and somebody drew a timeline and told me that we go from here to here. Similarly, at the National Gallery, I learned the story of the from the Renaissance to post-impressionism. Kids today are getting because of the nature of contemporary art, are getting a very different idea of what art is. And I'm trying to be neutral about it. Do we think it's a good thing or a bad thing, the way they're learning about art these days?
I think it's great, actually. I mean, it's hard to let go of the way I grew up learning about art, and certainly we need to have that as well. So I think that at some point she's going to need to have an art history lesson alongside the fun amusement part. But I like the idea as a model for this as a habit and novelty, where habit is the repeating over and over, and the long steady growth of history that, and then the novel, every once in a while these novel forms are introduced and then they persist and become habitual. So it's hard in the moment to see, especially when things change seemingly so radical, like when you contrast those two experiences, it does seem like a radical departure and that there must be something wrong. But I think in the grand scheme of things, it's the way it's always been. Like throughout our history, there's been novel approaches that have been introduced in the past that shook the foundations of their world then, the same way that yours is being shaken now. And it may have seemed illogical or hard to grapple with. Mm-hmm. But eventually it all starts to fall into, new branches form and continue on.
Yeah. What do you think, Vince?
I'm all for as many different types of art and experiences as we can possibly make. And I have a five-year-old son who I'm thrilled for him to experience all kinds of things. And he's always asking, is this art? Is that art? Is this a sculpture? Is it real? And I love that.
Pretty much the questions we all ask ourselves when we're walking around these fairs, yeah.
Or anywhere, out in New York, are things sculptures or is it art? Because we, it really blurs the line, and we live with a lot of art in our lives. And for him, I wonder what art means, because it's so everywhere around us, and all kinds of things are art, and then they're not, and what sort of categories he has going on, are certainly different than the ones I've had when I was growing up.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true, things are accelerating very quickly, as we mentioned earlier in our conversation. And that does seem to be overwhelming. Kids are growing up with the internet, and what kind of experience is that? How does that shape their worldview? There's certainly a lot going on, and it's the idea that it's sort of this global happening, and it's just changing very quickly. It's a big shift.
Yeah. Do you think, is it possible for an art to be too popular for its own good? By which I mean, if art becomes too accessible and too easy, in a sense, there's this common perception that attention spans have become very short, that it's much harder to go into a gallery and to spend your time contemplating one work and thinking about it. Things are very zappy and quick, and I wondered if we have a proliferation of that art, perhaps it would be at the expense of more difficult things. Do you think that's fair or not?
I think there's all kinds of work, and I think some things that may seem that way the first visit, maybe if you look at them a little more closely, maybe there's more there. And I think there's all kinds of different work and different ways of experiencing it. So it's a lot of variation. But I think it's a good thing.
I sort of think you might have something there. When there's too much of anything, your attention span necessarily becomes limited, and as a result, your enjoyment of something. For example, if you have one record to listen to in a week of free time, you'll really indulge in that record and get to know the music. And if you have 2,000, you'll be jumping from, what I do is jump from track to track, and I can't get involved in anything, I sort of lose my way. And to some degree, say, in an art fair, which is just such a visual glut, I find myself honing in on one piece, shutting out everything, and just focusing and absorbing and getting to know one or two things, and then moving quickly through some booths until I find the next thing. As just a sort of self-protective approach, because I want to have an experience, I want something to register and get that sort of poetic jolt that art can give you.
Yeah. And I have, we're in Miami, so it would be remiss of me not to mention how glamorous contemporary art has become. I mean, that's another, the first time I came here 3 years ago, I couldn't believe the parties, the social network, of course all the things that have made these fairs in Miami very successful. And again, similar to the last theme really, is there a point at which this kind of this glamorous environment is bad for art, or can it only be a good thing in that it just brings people together, it brings them in, it increases the interest? We're sitting here talking about art on a sunny morning. Yeah, it's getting sunny now. So is that something you feel good about, or?
Well, I think now certainly things are becoming a little more focused, and there is this, I guess a little bit of a circus-like atmosphere, and everyone wants to be part of it. Now there are so many different fairs, events, and things that are really not related to art at all, like fashion and all sorts of other worlds are interested in what's happening here. So that is, it's definitely overwhelming and can be distracting. Overall, I think it's exciting, but focusing it more on the essence of it and the art and boiling it down.
Yeah.
That is, it's hard to do here, but I think that's what, curators help us do, and kind of weeding out all these things that, helping us, crystallize something and put some things together for us and help, kind of pare things down. I think that's really critical. But that's not what's happening here for sure.
Yeah. Do you enjoy the glamour, Alexander?
With questions like this, I generally like to err on the side of open-mindedness rather than shutting it off. So I have to say I enjoy looking at everybody and all the fashions, and I'm a visual person, so it's thrilling just to see the clothes and hairstyles. I love it. And but what that signifies culturally, the glamour as a signifier, I don't know if that's bad for art. It's certainly fascinating, the merger, it just makes it, you know, just more of a visual kaleidoscope. It's fun.
Yeah, it must have an influence on the content of the art at some point, do you think, or not?
A little bit, or they're influencing each other. I mean, you know, I make paintings, but I look at sneaker design and sneaker treads, and I look at fashion, and I look at all kinds of stuff, and so it's all information that gets digested. And if this is our world now, and it's, you know, where there's money and art and there's fashion, it just seems to be the way it is.
Yeah.
So since that's a given, I'm sort of riding with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if I can talk to you a little bit about your clients, the people who buy your work. I always think of that famous scene in Woody Allen, I think it's Hannah and Her Sisters, where Max von Sydow plays the tortured artist, and along comes the rock and roll star and says, I want to buy some work from you. And he says, what do you want? And he says, I want something really big. And of course the artist is horrified by the fact that this man just wants what amounts to expensive wallpaper, and ends up by throwing him out and not receiving any money at all.
He says, I don't sell my drawings by the yard.
Exactly, thank you, that's the quote, yeah. Do you have any people like that coming up to you? I mean, more seriously, do you have... what are your relationships with your clients like? Have you ever kind of thought, I wonder if that person really gets this, but never mind, I'll sell him my work anyway?
Well, it's... you know, when you're here, it's a market, and your work is on the wall, and whoever wants to buy it can buy it. Generally, I mean, you hope that the collectors, you know, will kind of respect the work and treat it in a certain way. But I mean, for me, the highest compliment you can pay a work of art is to live with it and to want to have it. So that is, I feel really, you know, honored that people want my work and want to live with it and make it part of their lives. And I feel like an artwork, you may not quite get it when you first buy it, but it's something that you live with and you have a relationship with.
Mm.
And I know there are many pieces in my life that I learn new things about them all the time. So even though someone may not understand it, you know, I think it's like it's data, and introducing new data into your life, you know, that certainly can't hurt you.
Mm.
You know, and as a collector, when you're buying multiple things, and it's really these, you know, essences that are boiled down into these objects, and taking those and putting them together, that's a really powerful act, because it's expanding, and these multiple things are having these relationships. And so I think that, you know, I welcome people having it, and I think that it, you know, it's something that it can be learned from.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things about the art fair circuit is that it's made things much more transparent, because even only 20 or 30 years ago, buying a work of art had a slightly mysterious tinge to it. You know, you'd go into galleries, and the gallery would be quite intimidating, and you'd get this sense that the dealer was measuring you up, and is this person worthy enough to, you know, there was always that sense. But a lot of that is broken down with this kind of event.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And for your other question, I feel like I get a mixed group of people collecting, but mostly collectors seem to really appreciate the work and live with it. And I got a really nice comment from a collector once where he said, you know, I do business and I make money, and that's all I do, but you guys make the stuff that, you know, I wake up and I look at your piece when I'm having coffee, and it changes my world and it affects me all day. And it's the most important thing is the art, and I'm so happy with the things I own, and I look at them all the time, and I've collected a few things myself, and I have the same experience. I still love them, I still look at them, and I would say most collectors fall into that category.
Yeah. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about the what you both mentioned briefly, which is the global expansion, and particularly the move eastward, which I know is going to be the subject of one of our next discussions. But it does seem to me, you talked about Dubai and the Middle East, there's a whole thing going on there. There's China, of course, which is an enormous thing, India. These are very kind of unwieldy subjects. But what, do you get any sense that that the center of gravity of the contemporary art world is very much shifting, and is shifting away from us being the West.
I mean, I think there are certainly many more players and different interests, and I mean, just from, I guess there's all sorts of new collectors, and that seems like what's happening. And what, you know, like I said before, when one, you know, when someone falls down, other people stand up, and it seems like it's keeps kind of juggling.
Mm.
And you know, there seems to be more and more interest out of, you know, out of the U.S. and certainly my work in collectors in Lima and you know, Istanbul and Dubai and
yeah.
Korea and all around, all these places that I, you know, I'm excited to go and see what that's all about.
Yeah. Does that have any effect on how you see your own work? That knowing, I'm very interested, and it's again something we touched on in what effect, if any. Alexander, you said that you made a conscious effort to close it off, but you know, this feeling that there is a demand of your work, for your work, sorry, out there, and I wonder if you let any of that filter into how you approach your work.
Well, I think because I'm doing these commitments, I'm doing a lot of commissions, yeah. So they're site specific. So in Istanbul, I was really impressed with the you know, the architecture, the class, the geometry. I'm interested in these forms, and there I couldn't help but respond to all the things that were going on in that culture in Dubai, you know, looking at Islamic patterns and things like that. I find, you know, really an inspiration to my work. So mm-hmm. it does change my work, and when I go to a new place, it is like a new, all kinds of new things to filter and digest, and a lot of that makes it in on some level. So, you know, it's changing, and again, I see it as like new information or new things to kind of digest.
Yeah.
Yeah, the pressure is difficult, and it does seep in all kinds of different ways. The pressure to make more pieces to fill the demand, which is a question. Do I now try to make them faster in order to meet that demand, or I just keep doing what I'm doing? How do you know if you want to stay true to yourself, but being influenced by all these pressures and demands, and so being true to yourself changes, you know, who you see yourself as. It is definitely a tricky thing, and
it's hard. Yeah, I wondered if you ever find yourself catch yourself while you're in the middle of doing a piece of work and thinking, I'm not sure this is going to sell. I'm not sure this is going to be a popular one. But I feel I have to. There's something in me that I want to put down there. But you know, I wondered if that process even occurs.
Well, sometimes it threatens to, and I'm grappling with that. It's like, okay, a certain thing that I made didn't sell as fast as another thing, let's say. So it enters my mind, and then I'm like, what do I do with this? Like, you know, but in the end, I find it all. Maybe it's something that a good fortune that I have, that I find it almost impossible not to just do what I feel like doing. Whenever I get a directive, I stop. It all shuts down and I can't create. So I sort of have no choice but to just do my thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Same.
Being, you know, creative on command is definitely challenging, and especially, you know, when you have to go somewhere out of your comfort zone and you're working at, you know, some installation, and you know, you have a couple of days there and you have to make a piece.
Yeah.
Then that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
But I feel like the more you do it, not that it becomes easier, but I feel confident because I'm able, you know, I've been able to make work in the past, and I know that if I keep something like, it's almost like exercise.
Yeah.
When you do it, you know that you can, and you challenge yourself. So there's always these obstacles, but I feel like I need to, you know, my work is something that there's a lot of discovery when I'm making it. I have to let it happen. I have to create the conditions and hope that this thing will emerge from it, and it has. So I have to kind of trust that will happen.
Yeah.
And just go with it. I mean, certainly there are times when the results are, you learn something new, where you feel like, yes, this is a real discovery, and this, you know, pushed me further than I've gone before.
Uh-huh.
So in a way, it's really is almost like a, you know, like a relay race or some kind of endurance thing. And it's a challenge, but you just, you know, keep your head down and keep doing it and really focus on what it is for you.
I'm in awe of your abilities. I mean, you're not only are you creating under intense pressure, but you're managing so many different things, like multiple projects at one time, and people working with you, and problems that inevitably always arise. You know, that you are so balanced and calm about it is miraculous.
Well, is it easy to keep balanced and calm?
You know, it's you need a team of people, because often with these big commissions, you know, there's no way that I could, you know, do these things without having the involvement of a lot of people. So you really have to trust people and really be clear about what your role is. Like, what is my job? And I do my part and then hand off all the other parts to other people who can help you do those things. So that's been wonderful for me and allowed me to be able to scale my pieces. And really, I think about the essence of the piece, the programming, and really, you have to trust that it's going to happen. But it is, it's more, you know, it reduces the actual time of, you know, creativity in a way, because you're managing things,
yeah.
You're calling contractors, you're reviewing drawings, you're working out fabrication, working with programmers, engineers, debugging things. I mean, it's just like, it can be really overwhelming.
Yeah, and it reminds me that coming back to Damien Hirst, the last time he was in the news was last week, when it was revealed that he'd actually laid off some of the people who had been working in his workshop, because he decided to stop making butterfly paintings and because there was a recession on the way. And this was kind of given as a sign of the times, that even Damien Hirst is making people redundant, which is an extraordinary idea. And your work has quite a lot of technological sophistication, computer programming behind it, doesn't it? Which would not always be appreciated by people who just enjoy its decorative effects, perhaps. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, it's the work is all about numbers and sequences. But it, I'm an artist, and I came at technology from the art side. So I started programming very simple behaviors. Like, for instance, you see a certain color, and the rules for that, you know, for that pixel, let's say, or to, you know, go along in a certain direction, and when it reaches a boundary, to turn back. So you start with these very simple rules, and then you keep kind of adding elements to it and letting these things interact, and hoping that this kind of emergent behavior will occur in a way that you're trying to create something complex out of these very simple gestures. So I don't really expect people to know anything about the programming. If you can look at it, you can perceive, you know, certain elements, and there's some information there. So you're trying to understand it and decode it and make something up in your head, which is sort of a model in a way of playing on this, you know, this compulsion to pattern recognize.
Yeah.
And this is really the visual manifestation of the code. So instead of seeing it on a computer screen or as a projection, seeing it as light is very important to me, and the physical qualities that has and the impact of it, because it, you know, uses your full sensory perception and the saturation and the color, and these are things you just can't do with a projection or with a screen. So I think that there are multiple layers to it. You know, you can just perceive it as color, or if you want to look deeper, there are these other elements there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really what's such a breakthrough with your work and very kind of revolutionary, is that there's initial beauty of the piece, which strikes everyone right away. But then when you spend time with them and you start getting into the process and the mind behind why, the rationale behind why it's moving the way it does, and you spend time with it, start feeling it as like a living thing, and you start seeing your thoughts behind the movements, it has layers and depths that keep opening up.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's not making too tenuous a link, but Alexander, your work as well, it's been described as biomorphic. It has a relationship with nature, doesn't it?
absolutely a strong relationship with nature and a strong relationship with the synthetic, and I purposely allow those things to be sort of ambiguous and inexplicable. I made a decision early on not to title my paintings or drawings, so they're all untitled. It's a cataloging nightmare, but it sort of is a part of the way of thinking about the imagery, is not knowing the scale, the size, the reference. And you know, I'm keenly interested in technology and especially biosciences. I mean, I suspect, you know, if you read into current science literature, we'll be seeing art made of living things in the not too distant future, and certainly figuring out how to stem cells, how to regrow limbs and arms, and you know.
Yeah. So it's important. So you're both, your work is, in both of your cases, it's rooted in something other, if you like, mm-hmm. in patterns, and it's also quite, you're keeping technologically up to date, right. And I guess that helps you both take a fresh view into your work.
I have this idea that suddenly my paintings will make a lot more sense to everybody 100 years from now, when what they see in my paintings is more of a reality in our everyday life.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think also with, certainly in Alex's work, the idea that he's growing these paintings, and it's a very limited, restrained palette. It's almost like you have a certain, like, petri dish, and you make something, and you mold it, and your whole process of taking, like, a sculpting with clay, and then photographing it, and then painting it, and there's a whole series of steps that Alex goes through, which are it feels to me like almost like a laboratory, or there's like a scientific.
I love that side of it. Yeah, it is like a little science lab of my own creation. And the petri dish that you mentioned is extremely important to me. It's sort of the window through which I'm thinking about all of it. An art that could be alive, or an abstract painting that has grown itself into place, or somehow. So I tend to shut my thinking brain off when I'm working, and I try to let nature, you know, like the way leaves just fall randomly on the grass, I try to let that aspect of my brain just make the imagery sort of on its own, and let it sort of fall where
it has emergent quality.
Yeah.
Just let
try
create
to get in
the conditions, and then you kind of let it happen within a certain framework, and you're guiding it, but you don't know exactly how it's going to turn out.
Right.
Yeah. Now that's really interesting, and a very, very articulate way, I think, of describing a process which not all spectators would appreciate. Do you feel that there's some art around, and I'm not asking you to denigrate fellow artists, of course, but there is some that seems dedicated to making a quick impact, and that seems quite of the moment, and bang, and there don't seem to be layers behind it. Do you think that's fair? Or?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of one-liners out there, and I think that there are a lot of sexy materials, and I'm certainly using sexy material. And I think that raises the bar even more to actually create something that, you know, is, many people have described it as beautiful, but I think that comes from wanting to get to these underlying essences, and I think that's really what beauty is. So that's kind of one of the rules.
Yeah.
So getting, then actually having it be beautiful and use these sexy materials and actually have some idea behind it, have more layers, is I think it's a real challenge. But I feel confident that I can do that because I've had really this time to figure it out, and I think I'm on this track that it's taken a while, and I've learned so much from each piece, and I keep kind of moving forward. That is I think that's hard to. I think it's hard to do.
Yeah.
And it really does take time. And
my thinking with the one-liners sort of art, I believe that there's bad art, good art, and great art. And it's sort of a foundational way of looking at it. There has to be those distinctions. Otherwise, how can we know? And so given that that's true, if it's a one-liner, does it resonate? Is it a good piece of art? Does it stay with me? Some one-liners also resonate deeply, and some don't. So really, it's kind of simple. Is what category does the art fall into, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any precondition that says a one-liner piece of art can't also be a great piece of art. Often they're not, but there's no restriction there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to actually throw it open, if that's okay with either of you, because I'm sure some of you out there have got some questions, and it'd be nice to open it out and talk a little bit about that. So if you can think about any questions you have. But I'd like, and the sense I'm getting from both of you is you think it's a very healthy and thriving scene right now, despite the fact that there's a lot of cynicism about it. But you seem to be pretty optimistic about the way ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I it's not perfect, but I think it's I think in the end, all the energy and focus and all of it is certainly worth it.
Yeah,
I think it's great. China and India and all this, you know, it's just all adding to the big pie. I don't think that the center of gravity is shifting necessarily. I think, if anything, Asia sort of joining the West and the Western approach. I mean, this idea of individualism and the avant-garde and each artist his own unique island, something that they've taken up, you know, the contemporary young artists in China and India.
Do you think...
They're joining.
Yeah, sorry. Do you think that as contemporary art gets more and more eclectic and wide-ranging, it becomes more difficult to tell good art from great art from bad art than it was, say, 100 years ago?
I think it's more challenging. You need to know more, and you need to be more and more immersed in it. But in the end, you know, it's a consensus, so what's great to one person isn't great to another, but certain consensus forms and significant pieces rise to the top, and significant artists stand out, and it'll always be that way.
Yeah.
And you may not know, I mean, certain work that I just didn't understand, I couldn't wrap my head around it, and it took some time, and now it's like, of course, you know, this is really brilliant, so it may be that there's things that aren't valued now that should be, and, you know, things that are valued that, you know, maybe don't necessarily deserve that, but there is, I do believe it will all filter, and time will tell.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Now, do we have any question? Anybody like to lob a question? No? Not at all?
Let's get her up here.
Oh, okay. Sorry, can you just wait for one? Yeah.
I was in the Financial Times 10 years ago when they asked me what I'd spend $10,000 on.
Oh, yeah.
I bought some of the artists you mentioned at the beginning of their careers. So my response today was that I'd spend the $10,000 on traveling. And I'd want to come to Miami Basel to see where I live, because I think reading about art, like in the Financial Times, is one experience, but seeing art and then meeting the artists for me is the most important.
Yeah.
So I was just going to ask the two artists, Anthony, what artists have you met in Miami on this trip who's worked your exception?
You asking me?
Yeah. If you've had, I don't know how long you've both been here, but have
been
you had time?
Not
to
even 24 hours.
the truth is, I haven't met a whole lot of artists just now. But I got here yesterday. And I took some snapshots of art that I found interesting, but I'm sorry that it's... To my shame, I forget the artist's name and I didn't write it down.
Have you engaged very much yet?
It's been kind of a whirlwind of parties, events, you know, lots of great art. Nate Lohman's show is really exciting. And, you know, there's a real kind of punk art feeling to places I went last night, which I love, the youthful energy, music, you know, let's do something in a warehouse, and let's just take over this lot and do our own thing. And even people who are, you know, just anyone can kind of jump in. And I mean, it does add to the kind of carnival-like atmosphere.
Yeah.
But I think that certainly, like, great things can happen there. And definitely inspiring.
I guess the energy thing is what I was thinking about when I was talking about rock and roll, and you said punk. You know, I mean, famously, a lot of the great pop musicians in London of the 60s were trained in art school, and they brought a lot of that energy which they got from art into rock music, and I think some of it's come back the other way as well, and they're both sort of helping each other. Anyone else like to ask any questions at all? Yeah.
This is a question for all of you. Hi, President of New York. Thanks for the panel. My question is, in the middle of this kind of recessionary market where everybody is affected, what kind of strategies or do you plan to alter in order to promote your works to sell more work, more art, or how do you plan to go about adjusting yourselves, your businesses, or your artwork to this new market?
Okay. A good nitty gritty business question. Okay, and we've addressed the R word at last.
Yeah.
So,
well, for me, I'm involved in all these large scale projects and doing, you know, buildings and working with developers and things all over, and that is very much dependent on all the things happening in the economy. And so some projects may, you know, slow down or maybe, you know, sort of reshuffling. It seems like people are still, I mean, we're still going for it and doing things. It's maybe not on the same exuberant level that it was, but things are still moving forward. So you just sort of have to see how it goes. I mean, I never know what's going to happen with these big projects. You know, maybe it will happen, maybe it won't. So, you know, sometimes it takes 3 years or longer. You just have to kind of stick it out and kind of roll with it on that end. In my studio, I'm still making my pieces, doing my thing, developing my code, and just kind of keep your head down and keep doing it. I mean, I think now it's time. We have to do it. We can't not do it. So,
yeah, I'll always continue making my art. It's what I've always done. There's no reason to stop. I don't need much to make art. But, you know, if things don't improve, I'll have to scramble somewhat, just like any business. You know, some galleries cut staff a little. I'll maybe reduce the size of my studio, cut some overhead, things like that. Whatever it takes.
Do either of you or both of you actually enjoy the business aspects of your work, that you have to think about these things?
Well, I mean, if you ask any artist what they want, they just want to make their work. They want the time and the freedom and the space and the money. They don't want to think about it. They want to just make their work. So I don't enjoy it at all. I avoid it. I compartmentalize. I mean, I focus on the poetic side of creation, and I ignore my taxes and, you know, all that stuff. So, and you know, that's my specialty.
Well, I mean, because the materials I use, you know, they're expensive, these LEDs and all these things, you know, I have to be really careful about, you know, I use a spreadsheet like almost daily, and so there's a lot of economic reality to what I do. I have to be, you know, careful about it, because people are planning and we're doing these things, so that's just part of the deal. And I'm not sure if I don't mind the, like, business side of it. Mm-hmm. It's just part of what you have to do to make these things happen. So there's all these hoops I have to jump through to, like, pull off, like, a, you know, project like at the National Gallery. You know, it's a 200-foot long space with over 40,000 LEDs, and, you know, it was, like, 3 years of making and doing presentations and testing and making custom injection molded clips in China, which we had to make 10 versions of to get it right. And there's all this, you know, very unglamorous behind the scenes stuff that went on. But in the end, I get to sit there and work with this incredible, you know, space and create a, you know, really amazing piece.
Yeah. Did the fact that you were commissioned to do a major public project, did that make you approach the work differently? Was that a pressure in itself, that you were producing something that was meant to be an important presence in a public place, not in somebody's bedroom or something?
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, it's a IM pay space, part of the original, you know, design. So dealing with the architecture, you know, and not, you know, you don't want to put something like a big Christmas ornament on top of the space and have it be kind of overwhelming. My goal is always to make the pieces integrated so it feels right. And the piece there feels, you know, just feels right. And that's been the response of so many people. And it's a very public space. They have like 5 million visitors a year. Yeah. And you have to use that space to get from one, you know, one building to the other. So it, people really use it. And I wanted it to not be an overwhelming experience. So there was a lot of tuning of the piece and making it feel right. So there's, yeah, a tremendous amount of concern for the people who have to live with this thing and making it, you know. I'm still doing my piece. So, you know, there's a lot of concern that, well, maybe people will have seizures, you know, the flash and all these things, because people think of light and sequence light and didn't really understand what that meant. Mm-hmm. But I think that now that they've seen it, you know, it just feels right. And in a way, the piece is like a musical instrument, to where I've had to kind of tune it so it's just right. And I feel really, you know, comfortable with it and pleased that it, you know, it is right.
Yeah, good. Would anyone like? Yes, thank you.
Speaking of that particular piece,
microphone coming. Okay.
Speaking of that particular piece at the National Gallery, as I understood it, a year's installation is planned, and that how will they store it? For, you know, yeah. How do museums care for your work?
Well, it is a site-specific piece, so, you know, there's no way to put that somewhere else. It would be on you for a year, and then they, you know, we'll see what happens after that. Hopefully the museum will acquire it and we'll set it. But there was a lot of concern, especially with art that you have to plug in. How long is it going to last? And that's a huge concern of mine as well. The LEDs themselves are good for 100,000 hours, at least that's one of the metrics of the manufacturers. And so that's 11 and a half years if you're burning it constantly. But because of modulating the light levels, doing all these things, the life is extending further. And we've gone through extensive, you know, a lot of planning to make sure that they have all the parts that they need, you know, in case something happens. But it is, I mean, it is a commitment, but I think that, you know, they feel comfortable enough that we're, you know, been able to proceed, and we have backups. So I think we'll be good, and I think they're okay with that.
Does it distress you at all that it's going to be gone? You know, it's the ephemerality of it.
No, I really like the temporary quality of art, doing things that are, you know, last a certain amount of time, and then that's it.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, the work is very ephemeral. You know, it's very fleeting, and it's almost like adding another layer to it. But it's very subtle.
Yeah.
But I think when it's off, people really miss it. I mean, when the lights go out there, everyone goes, oh, and getting a lot of public response. So it's, you know, it's nice to see people be able to respond to the work.
Sure. I'm sure this happens in New York too, but in London we have these things called pop-up restaurants now, which are, so like there's a Royal Academy exhibition of contemporary art on at the moment, and there's a restaurant, a very good restaurant, that's just suddenly materialized, a so-called pop-up restaurant there, and it's going to be on for the show. And when the show goes, the restaurant goes, and it seems like ephemerality is kind of spreading into other fields as well. Which is a curious idea. Maybe banking as well. Does anybody else have any questions at all? No, okay. Shall we, I think we've really examined the subject from lots of different points. So thanks to both of you. Thank you all for coming. And enjoy your Miami experience. Thank you.